Win stacks of cash by entering the 150K Crack the Code giveaway, brought to you by your local paper, now through July 14th. Look for the code on page A2. Then visit 150kgiveaway.com and submit your entry. You could win the grand prize of $100,000. Grab the paper every day. Get the code on page 2A and improve your chances to win tons of weekly cash prizes. Visit 150kgiveaway.com for details.
Inside Florida Politics. The Essential Podcast, powered by Gatehouse Florida. I'm Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett, coming to you from the heart of the 561 in West Palm Beach, Florida. And I'm joined, as always, by Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson.
Hey, George.
And from Tallahassee by the Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief, John Kennedy.
Hi, George.
All right. Well, the calendar industry and a lot of so-called experts are insisting that it's 2019, but don't believe it. In Florida, 2020 is here. President Donald Trump is formally launching his 2020 campaign with a rally in Orlando. And the top 20 Democrats running for president are coming to Miami later this month for a debate, or actually debates, because the two debates, because Fire Marshal wouldn't allow all of them on stage at once. Also, Democratic National Committee Chairman Tom Perez was in the state recently to pledge that the National Party will back what he called an unprecedented voter registration and organizational effort to win Florida next year after Trump carried the state in 2016. So we'll have a lot of 2020 Florida stuff to talk about on the podcast. Perez, he was speaking at a Florida Democratic Party confab at Walt Disney World, where one of the many interesting questions that arose is one we've posed before here on the podcast, and that is who exactly is the face of Florida Democrats these days? We'll talk about two of the leading candidates for that unofficial but significant title. And that's not all. John Kennedy is going to tell us about some BAFO fundraising figures for Governor Ron DeSantis, and he'll also fill us in on the latest on a couple of proposed constitutional amendments to ban assault weapons and raise the minimum wage. But first, I think I hear some funky royalty-free music playing. And listeners to the podcast know whenever you hear that music, it means it's time for our Pick a Number segment. That is the portion of the podcast where each of us puts forward a number, and then later on we explain what that number means in Florida politics. John Kennedy, why don't you go first? What number do you have for us?
Sure, George. I have number 16 this week.
Sweet 16 for John Kennedy in Tallahassee. Zach Anderson, what about you?
My number this week is 5,500.
5,500, 5,500 if you're taking notes for Zach Anderson. We do encourage taking notes as long as you're not driving a car or operating heavy machinery. And my number, George Bennett, is going to be 26. So just to review those numbers very quickly, 16 for John Kennedy, 5,500 for Zach Anderson, and 26 for me, George Bennett. Hang on to those numbers and listen to the end of the podcast when we explain what they mean in Florida politics. But let's get straight to our loaded lineup. President Donald Trump filed papers with the Federal Election Commission on January 20th, 2017, his inauguration day, to open his 2020 reelection campaign. And he's held multiple campaign rallies around the U.S., including several in Florida. But the rally that he's holding on Tuesday, June 18th, at the Amway Center in Orlando with Vice President Mike Pence, is being billed as the formal kickoff to his 2020 reelection campaign. John Kennedy, you go first. Tell us about the significance of this particular rally and where the president has chosen to hold it.
Well, it's no surprise. I guess maybe it's Florida. Trump is largely trying to reuse the electoral map that won him the presidency in 2016, you know, even as he lost the national popular vote. And a redo of his election in Florida, the biggest of the battleground states, is pretty critical to him. It's interesting. A poll of 10 competitive states that came out this week by Morning Consult shows that Trump is ahead in approval ratings in only two states, Indiana and Florida, with a Florida governor here and a who's a Republican and a Republican controlled legislature. Trump should be pretty well positioned to get plenty of help as he runs against whoever the Democrats ultimately nominate. But these polls show that Florida is really the only swing state where Trump looks as strong as he did on Election Day 2016. Really, everywhere else, his support has dwindled. So this Orlando event, has some added significance in that it's underscoring a state that he really needs badly.
Yeah, you know, Trump, well, actually, Florida always is an important state. But in 2016, actually, Trump could have lost Florida and still won the electoral vote. But any Republican calculation for 2020, Florida is an essential part of it for President Trump. Zach, what are your thoughts on the president's rally and holding it right in the heart of Florida?
Yeah, I mean, if Florida is critical, the Orlando-Tampa media markets are the most critical part of the most critical state for Trump. You know, it's the vaunted I-4 corridor. It's almost become a cliche about how important this region has become in presidential politics, but it's true. I mean, this is the sort of the swingiest region in the biggest swing state in the country. If you look at media spending, Florida was the most money was spent by presidential campaigns of any state in 2016, $168 million, according to Kantar Media. So Florida was the most money spent, and the Tampa and Orlando media markets were second and third in the country in terms of the most money spent, behind only Boston, where the candidates advertised during the New Hampshire primary. So Tampa, Orlando is really those two media markets really make up the I-4 corridor. It's about 19 counties in those media markets. They're absolutely critical to winning the state. You have a lot of swing voters, a lot of retirees from the Midwest and the Northeast, a lot of Hispanic voters, people who coming from Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. It's a interesting mix of people, and it really does tend to be sort of a bellwether for where the state goes. Now, Mitt Romney actually did win the I-4 corridor by a small margin in 2012, but Obama went on to win the state. So it's not critical that that you necessarily win it, but it is critical to put up some good margins and to hold down the margins of your opponents. Trump improved on Romney's performance in the I-4 counties by 190,000 votes and went on to win Florida by 114,000 votes. So his improvement in the I-4 region, made up a good portion of that margin of victory.
All right. So President Trump will be, we're recording this podcast on Thursday, the 13th of June, and President Trump will be in Orlando on the 18th. So before our next podcast drops, and Zach Anderson and other Gatehouse folks will be at the Trump rally in critical Florida. Well, Democrats, as we mentioned, are coming later this month for their debates in Miami, but also the Florida Democratic Party recently held its annual Leadership Blue conference and fundraiser at Walt Disney World this past weekend, and the none of the major presidential candidates showed up. It was a little bit of an embarrassment for the party. They were all in Iowa. But the Democratic National Committee Chairman Tom Perez was there as the headline speaker. And in an interview with me and in his speech at a Saturday night dinner, he said that the party is going to work hard to win back Florida after, you know, Barack Obama carried the state twice, but then Trump carried it by 1.2% in 2016, which is actually a pretty big margin considering the way Florida elections go. Here's one clip from DNC Chairman Tom Perez talking to me at Disney World.
We're organizing early. We're organizing everywhere. We're leading with our values and telling a very, very clear story of the contrast between what we're fighting for and what this president is doing. He has a track record now. Didn't have a track record 4 years ago.
Okay, so certainly, Trump was able to campaign as an outsider and a change agent in 2016, and Perez is saying, well, now he's got a record to defend. And then here is a clip of two of the issues actually that he asked that he said would be key in Florida and probably in other states. One is the Affordable Care Act. The Democrats believe that the Trump's opposition to the Affordable Care Act will hurt him with voters in Florida. And then also a more Florida specific one. He said the president's response to the hurricanes that racked Puerto Rico would be a big negative for him in Florida because of so many Puerto Ricans that live in Florida and including those that came over here after those hurricanes. So he believes those will be issues that'll play well for Democrats. Here's during his speech to the to this dinner of Florida Democrats. Here is another comment that that Chairman Tom Perez made about Florida.
Latino voters in this state who we believe are Democrats. And what we're doing is we're working together to identify them, to register them, and to make sure we tell them why it is important to be a Democrat.
Okay, so one focus that Democrats will have, as Perez outlined there, is registering more Hispanic voters. And notice the way he phrased it, though. He said 400,000 unregistered Latino voters who we believe are Democrats. Translation, the Democratic Party is not going to be trying to register Cuban-American voters who tend to lean Republican, but they're going to be focusing on these voters that they identify as prospective Democrats. In Florida, the Hispanic vote, as we've remarked before, is a lot more diverse and just different from the Hispanic vote in the rest of the country. I think in the 2018 midterms, overall, Republicans got something like 30% of the Hispanic vote in all their different races. But in Florida, Rick Scott and Ron DeSantis at the top of the ticket were able to get in the mid to high 40% of the Hispanic vote. Also in Florida, the Hispanic turnout in 2018, at least, was very disappointing compared to other groups. I think Hispanic turnout was only 49% in Florida compared to 59% overall statewide turnout. So Democrats have a chore to they want to register more Latino voters who they think are sympathetic to Democrats, and then they will have to work hard to get them to turn out. But that is a key part of the strategy that Tom Perez outlined in his remarks to the Florida Democratic Party. I want to play two other clips real briefly. One is at this Florida Democratic Party event, because of President Trump's focus on Florida, some Democrats see that as kind of giving them a little bit of an edge. Here is Christian Olvert. He is a Miami-based Democratic consultant. Here he is talking about the 2020 race in Florida.
It's getting more interesting because the Trump campaign has made it clear, right, that their path to victory starts and ends with Florida.
Right.
So it puts Florida Democrats, the Florida Democratic Party, and whoever our nominee is in an interesting position because literally, in some ways, our job is to build a roadblock.
Yeah.
Right. And it's not a 50-state strategy and, you know, 10-swing state strategy. The Trump campaign has signaled that if we are successful at building a great roadblock in Florida, we have prevented the Trump campaign from winning.
Okay, so if Trump is focused on Florida, then Democrats believe they can if they can make a roadblock here in Florida, they will thwart his reelection bid. One thing that's interesting, you know, there's obviously a lot of talk at this Democratic conference about 2020, but there was also a considerable amount of grumbling among party activists about 2018 when the party lost these very close races at the top of the ticket for Senate and governor. And the party chairwoman Terry Rizzo commissioned this Path to Power report that was supposed to dissect the 2018 results. But when the conference came around and all these activists were there in one place, the report wasn't ready. And one of the co-chairs, Sean Shaw, gave an overview that a lot of people thought was pretty short on specifics. Here is Shaw talking about the Path to Power report.
Nothing is groundbreaking in there.
Yeah.
This is a lot of blocking and tackling that we need to do a better job of as Democrats. This is outreach to communities of color. This is putting resources on the ground. This is helping DECs operate better. This is communications. It's messaging. It's data. These things are, you know, Democrats come together at these conventions and we gripe and we mumble and we complain to each other. Well, I think this report is going to have a lot of those things in there, but I think the difference this time is the party's committed to having the resources behind it to help.
So there you have it. Looking ahead to 2020 for Florida Democrats and still some griping about 2018. You know, one of the interesting things that came up at this Florida Democratic Party gathering is, and we've discussed it here in the podcast before, well, who exactly is the face of Florida Democrats in the Sunshine State? The new agriculture commissioner, Nikki Freed, is the only Democrat now to hold statewide office. So she has a claim to the title, and she got a very enthusiastic reception wherever she went at this conference. But Andrew Gillum, who was the 2018 nominee for governor and narrowly lost to Ron DeSantis, I would say he got a more enthusiastic response from folks when certainly when he hosted a reception Friday night at this conference. Now, in one way, that's understandable because governor is a higher profile office than ag commissioner, and Gillum's a very dynamic speaker and charismatic figure. But it's worth noting that Gillum was appearing just hours after the Florida Ethics Commission had finalized a $5,000 fine against him for the controversy that came up in the 2018 campaign over accepting gifts from lobbyists. And then also the Tampa Bay Times recently broke the story that a federal grand jury has issued a subpoena for records related to Gillum's 2018 campaign and some of the people closely associated with him. Gillum is currently leading this effort to register a million more voters in the state. And so he talked a little bit about the new controversy surrounding him when he spoke to them. Let's play that clip.
Listen, y'all, there are consequences when you challenge power. There are consequences when you try to move power from the hands of a few to the many. There are consequences when you challenge the status quo. Well, I want y'all to know that while we'll be compliant through whatever inquiry they may have, we are not going to be distracted. We got a job to do. We've got work to do. Because I'm committed, and I know you are committed, and as the signs around this room already indicate, it's our job to flip Florida blue in 2020.
Okay, and here's one other comment that he made a little later in his remarks.
So I want you to know I'll take the slings, I'll take the arrows, I'll take the name calling, I'll take all of that, so long as I know that you all are in this with me to organize this state and to turn out our voters.
Zach and John, I want to get your thoughts briefly on that. I mean, so Gillum is basically saying that, there's this distraction going on, but, it's kind of a consequence of him challenging the status quo, and he's this figure that's going to take the slings and arrows and press on. What do you think about that, Zach Anderson?
It's fascinating to me that Democrats continue to lionize Gillum. They had a very winnable race in 2018, but Gillum, he couldn't get the job done. He probably lost some votes by saying that he would raise taxes. But even more importantly, as you pointed out, George, he had ethical issues that dogged him during the campaign. And, you know, they may have tipped the race to Ron DeSantis. He paid a $5,000 fine to the Florida Ethics Commission for accepting a gift of more than $100 from a city lobbyist while he was Tallahassee mayor. And you noted that he is the subject of a federal grand jury subpoena. You know, these are not just like things that were made up by his opponents. These are legitimate issues, but the base still loves him because he's charismatic and he says all the right things. Just like the base of the GOP still loves Trump despite all of his controversies. It just sort of shows that the tribal nature of our politics can lead to people ignoring questions of character, which used to be so important in politics.
Now, the other figure I mentioned who, you know, makes a claim to being or can make a claim to being the leader of the Florida Democratic Party is Nikki Freed. And she in fact, is she made it clear when she was talking to reporters that she takes her role seriously, you know, as far as being the only statewide elected Democrat. Here she is talking about whether she would make an endorsement in the presidential race.
I plan on endorsing somebody. I'm going to wait until after the presidential debates at the end of this month and talk to more constituents across the state, recognizing that my voice carries some water in the state and want to make sure that my voice is speaks on behalf of our citizens.
Okay, so she's mindful. She said her voice carries some water in the state. And she was asked then if, you know, she didn't really give any hints of who she might endorse, but she was asked by one reporter if she would prefer to have a woman as president. Here's what she said to that.
Well, I always prefer a woman. I mean, of course, you know, as far as, you know, women in leadership, we saw a record number of women running last year, a record number of women that were running and winning. And I think that women in leadership positions changes the conversation. We have a different way of dealing with issues, a different way of negotiating through things. We leave our egos at the door and we're looking for solutions driven. And I think that that women in general, not just in politics, but companies and CEOs of law firms, you'll start seeing more and more women step up to take those leadership roles.
John Kennedy, what's your thought? Freed or Gillum, who's the leader of the party? And what do you think, what weight do you think a Nikki Freed endorsement in the presidential race might carry with Democrats?
Yeah, it's quite a toss-up right now. I mean, I think Gillum has something of a higher national profile right now. He's drawn more attention from media for his run for governor. But I think Nikki Freed is quietly doing a lot of smart things right now. She's been responding to breaking news, sending out fundraising emails in the wake of the stricter abortion laws that are being passed in many southern states. And also, she recently sent out another fundraising pitch in response to some homophobic remarks that were attributed to a Pensacola Republican state house member, Mike Hill. She quietly right now has about $250,000 in her Florida Consumers First political committee. And she, too, is likely to be a big presence in helping Democrats in next year's campaigns. You know, very much like Gillum, she's young and a smart political voice. And so far, she's free from any political baggage. And that's something Gillum is collecting, it seems like, right now. And the cloud of a statewide defeat last fall for Gillum, you know, that's a setback. You can't deny that. So, you know, here's Nikki Freed. She won, and she's the only statewide elected Democrat in Florida. And I think that's going to resonate. And I think her profile is going to get higher as the months go on.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see when she makes an endorsement in the presidential race, you know, what effect that has on Florida Democrats. Well, you mentioned Nikki Freed's fundraising. And John, tell us also about some fundraising numbers for Governor Ron DeSantis.
Yeah, interesting. This week, reports have just come in, you know, the quarterly campaign finance reports from various political committees. And Ron DeSantis, since the legislature broke camp after 2 months during the first weekend of May, the governor, he's been pretty busy. He's quietly taken in money. And finance reports show that his Friends of Ron DeSantis political spending committee took in about $437,000 last month. the biggest individual donors, $50,000 from Disney World and $50,000 from the Florida Chamber of Commerce. Now, both of these organizations were pretty favored in the legislature. Disney got a $5 million tax break that allows it and other retailers to avoid paying taxes, sales tax, it should be, on leftover inventory that they don't sell but donate to charity, kind of an arcane tax provision, but it was hotly sought by Disney and a few others. And the chamber was one of the big advocates for the controversial legislation that DeSantis signed that sets in motion plans to create three new tollways in Florida. So for DeSantis, the money shows that he's kind of muscling up to play in next year's elections. He's going to have a cushion of cash that he can use to heighten his profile. He can help some Republican friends in the legislature who are seeking reelection. And then, of course, I think help President Trump's reelect, which is the main role for many Republican office holders in the months ahead. So DeSantis is, expected to continue pushing for more cash. He's going to be out there quietly fundraising continuously, I think. And but when you look at the month after the session ends, with the budget still awaiting his signature, this is a good time for him to be passing the hat. And it won't be the first time the donors are going to be asked to give to the governor's campaign.
All right. And yeah, so he's still working through signing or deciding whether to sign different bills presented to him by the legislature. One bill that he did sign that we have spoken about in the past makes it more difficult to get constitutional amendments to the ballot. John Kennedy, tell us a little bit about that and about two particular constitutional amendments dealing with assault weapons and the minimum wage.
Yeah, these are a couple of initiatives that the Republican legislature and Republican constituencies are very wary of. Yet they're, despite the legislation that the governor signed that is going to make it more difficult for these initiative campaigns to collect signatures, these ideas seem to be moving forward. This week, the Ban Assault Weapons Now organization said it has gotten more than 100,000 signatures. That tops the 10% that's needed of the 766,000 that must be collected to win a place on the ballot. And when you get to that 10% level, that's what triggers a Florida Supreme Court review, because the court has to, eye the proposed ballot language to make sure it's constitutional. So that looks like it's moving forward. It's something that, the NRA and gun advocates in the state are very, distrustful of. It would put prohibitions on high capacity gun magazines and weapons in the state. And then, of course, there's another proposal that also has collected more than that 10% level. And that's a proposal to increase the minimum wage. This is one that trial lawyer John Morgan, who is a big financier of says earlier campaigns like medical marijuana approval in the state. This is another idea that the business community is very scared of. And the legislation that the Florida legislature approved in the closing hours of this session, it prohibits paying petition gatherers per signature. This is not a deal breaker for these campaigns, but it's a hurdle that's probably going to increase the cost of these ballot campaigns. And there are other controversial measures that are out there, too, that, again, Republican constituencies are kind of wary of. And that one would deregulate the electrical industry, and another one would expand Medicaid. And these two also are advancing, but whether they'll get the appropriate number of signatures and Supreme Court approval to make it to the ballot is a question. But the court itself now also emerges as a potential wild card for these ballot ideas, because you got to remember the 7-member court has three new justices that were appointed in January by Governor DeSantis. And if the legislature doesn't trip up the signature gathering with its new legislation, the justices could be the unknown factor right now, since they could easily discover a problem with the ballot proposals that are going forward. But anyway, despite the best efforts of the legislature to kind of put a crimp into the initiative petition process, it looks like it's moving forward, and at least in a couple of key areas.
We will have to stay on top of that. All right. Well, I think I hear that funky royalty-free music again. Means it's time to return to our pick a number segment. Note takers, of course, are aware that John Kennedy led with a 16. John, tell us about that number 16. What does that mean?
Yeah, 16 is the number of days left between when Governor DeSantis is expected to receive the state's $91.1 billion budget and when it takes effect on July 1st. The legislature has taken its sweet time in sending the document over to the governor for his review, but the governor this week said he expects it to arrive by Friday the 14th, which is we're recording this on a Thursday, so it's looming. And that would, by law, give him 15 days to act on the budget before the, it takes effect. And July 1st is when the fiscal year starts. There didn't seem to be really any strategy to this long rollout of the budget. But just by contrast, when the legislature approved the budget last year, the governor, Rick Scott, at that time, he signed the state budget a mere 5 days after it was approved by the legislature. So this year's 6 week gap seems to be, an inordinate space. But, last year was an election year and people were eager to get things done from the legislature and get out on the campaign trail. But this time there doesn't seem to be quite the same concern. And it's just been lagging as far as getting it out. But it is kind of funny because going back, there was a time 30 years ago when the legislature moved the start of the session to earlier in the year, basically to the kind of March-April calendar that we're on now, because a lot of government agencies were complaining about the budget being so uncertain as it got close to the July 1st start of the fiscal year. Well, here we are. We had the early session again this year, but again, the budget is not going to be approved until pretty darn close to the start of that fiscal year.
A lot of suspense.
Absolutely.
All right. Zach Anderson, 5,500.
Yeah, so 5,500 votes is Trump's margin of victory in Pinellas County, Florida. Why is that important? Because Obama won Pinellas County by 25,846 votes in 2012. So Trump flipped Pinellas from blue to red, and it was the most prominent example of his strength in the I-4 corridor, which I mentioned earlier. One reason Trump likely did well in Pinellas is because it's 74% white. The I-4 counties Trump did best in were the whitest, and he probably had a good chance of winning many of those votes again, I think, in 2020. His appeal to blue-collar white voters has often been attributed to his aggressive approach to illegal immigration and, his protectionist trade proposals. And those are two issues he has maintained pretty much an unwavering focus on during his presidency. So if he can maintain that sort of strength with, those white working class voters in the I-4 corridor, he probably has a decent chance in Florida. You look at Volusia County, where you have Daytona Beach. That's a county that Mitt Romney won very narrowly in 2012 and just went to Trump by a huge margin in 2016. Also a very high percentage of white voters. Citrus County, north of Tampa, Hernando County, Pasco County, all very high percentages of white voters. And Trump's margin of victory was much higher than Romney's over Obama. So he really padded his margin in a lot of these counties in the I-4 corridor that were very heavily white. Clinton won in Hillsborough County and Orange County, which are much more diverse, but it just wasn't enough. So it's kind of the same story that it was for Trump nationwide and throughout Florida. But the I-4 corridor is critical. So I think people are going to be watching to see, what happens in places like Pinellas very closely in the coming year.
All right. Interesting analysis there. My number is 26. 26 is a self-indulgent number. It's the number of years that I've been a reporter at the Palm Beach Post. But my time here is soon coming to an end because I'm going to be pursuing an exciting new opportunity outside of journalism. So this is my final podcast, and I just want to say that I have thoroughly enjoyed gorging myself at the all-you-can-eat buffet of news that we have here in Florida for these many years. And I'm especially proud to have worked at the Palm Beach Post with the incredibly talented and dedicated group of journalists that we have here. It's an amazing newsroom, and it's been an exhilarating place to work. It's also been an honor to be part of the Florida Press Corps with you guys and the other reporters around the state. I'm biased, but I'm truly convinced that Florida has the best press corps of any state. And finally, it's been a lot of fun hosting this podcast and talking politics with you gentlemen. But I will no longer be behind the microphone, but I will continue to be an Inside Florida Politics subscriber and listener. And with that, we close this podcast. So for the final time, I am Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett, and I've been joined by Zach Anderson of the Sarasota Herald Tribune and John Kennedy, the Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief in Tallahassee. And we've been assisted here by Corzano. That's the team of Thomas Cordy and Joe Forzano lining up all those audio clips. And always the man that makes it happen from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, the digital audio production director for Gatehouse, Adam Fish. Thank you.